Welcome to our time together. We are doing courses through the Bible, studying various subjects, and we're doing a 13-part series now on background characters in the Old Testament. These are stories about some of the little lesser known individuals in the Old Testament that can teach us some important lessons. Let's bow our heads and begin with a word of prayer. Our kind and loving Father, we're so thankful to have this opportunity to study from the Scriptures, to learn about some of the lesser known people from the Old Testament, to see what we can discover that will help us. May these characters in their various aspects, their various characteristics, give us guidance for our lives today is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Mm-hmm. Everybody who knows much about the Bible at all has heard of David. Many of those who've studied the life of David are familiar with a young lady by the name of Abigail. And this lesson focuses on Abigail. Abigail was an intelligent young woman, courteous, respectful, beautiful. Her story, in some respects, reminds us of the story of Esther in the book of Esther. And it resembles, in some ways, the story of Judith in the Apocrypha, for those who are familiar with that story. But in this story, the basic story of Abigail is told in 1 Samuel 25. So if you have a Bible handy, it would be ideal if you could open that up and have a look at 1 Samuel 25. We're going to actually begin partway through the first verse, and then we'll talk about what really happened. After this, David went to the wilderness of Paran. There was a man of the clan of Caleb named Nabal, who was from the town of Maon and who owned land near the town of Carmel. So, to back up a little bit, we'll talk about the three main characters. It's very likely that the marriage of Abigail and Nabal was arranged. In those days, most marriages were arranged, probably by the bride's parents. A large dowry was probably paid for her. It's doubtful that she had any choice in the marriage whatsoever. One wonders what kind of a relationship existed between Nabal and Abigail. We know her as a young, beautiful, presumably healthy woman, but she and Nabal never had any children. So let's look at the story, and let's look at the characters. Nabal was a rich man. He owned large flocks, or probably scattered over a large area in the southern part of what we would call Judea, or the southern part of Judah, as it was divided up into tribal territories in those days. Such large flocks, with no fences, you could imagine, and no property laws to speak of, would be easy prey for the marauding bands of Moabites, Amalekites, and Philistines, and there were plenty of those around in those days. As we mentioned, Nabal was a descendant of Caleb, and you remember we talked about Caleb already. Caleb was a very honest, very intelligent man who stuck to his guns and said, "Yes, we can. I trust in the Lord." This is a man of faith. So Nabal's descendant, however, wasn't quite of the same character. Although he was of the tribe of Judah, as was David. David's men, and you remember at this point in time, let's just get the story clear, at this point in time, Saul was still king in Israel. And he had it out for David. He was determined to get rid of this David because he knew that David had been appointed by God to be the next king of Israel. And he thought the only way, Saul thought the only way he could have his descendants continue to reign after he was dead was to get rid of David. And so over a number of chapters, we have stories again and again and again about Saul's efforts to try to destroy David. Well, as a result of that, several things happened. First of all, David escaped into Judean territory, and of course his tribe was Judah, and they would tend to defend him opposed to the Saul, who was from the tribe of Benjamin. So he was a little safer in Judean territory. Secondly, it turned out that almost anybody else who had some kind of a beef with the government of Saul would escape to David. So pretty soon he had quite a number of men with him. Not all of them were sterling characters. They were probably quite a few rascals in the bunch, outlaws and various kinds of people. that were following David. He had 600 men that were with him at the time of this story. And they were more or less hiding out in southern Judah. Well, there they helped police the area and protected the flocks of the people who had flocks there from these other tribes. If the Philistines tried to come in, David and his men would attack them and push them back. If the Amalekites or the Moabites or the Ammonites came in, these people would jump to the rescue and chase these people back. So Nabal had actually received a lot of benefit from having David and his men in his territory. But when the shearing season came late in the spring, David sent 10 of his men to Nabal to ask for a gift from him in payment for the protection that his men had provided Nabal's flocks over the winter. Now, let me just ask you all, does that sound like a reasonable thing to do? I mean, David says, here, we've been here, and we don't have any regular source of income from the government, that's for sure. We've been helping you. How about some help here? We got 600, well, and this is 600 men, not counting women and children. I mean, how many mouths were there to feed?
He shouldn't even have to ask.
No.
If he was doing a service, Nabal should have paid them.
Yeah.
What's strange is David had 600 men and their wives and children, and you say he was hiding?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
The only way he managed that was to more or less keep on the move. They couldn't stay any place permanently. They would stay in one place for a while, and Saul would get word where they were, and he'd send his army down there to capture them, and they would have to jump to someplace else. And
Okay. The
way they survived was to have enough spies themselves, enough watchmen out, so that when they saw someone sort of either telling Saul's army where they were, or they saw Saul's army approaching, they would run off. And of course, we know there were a couple of times when Saul came right up to them, and one time he was relieving himself in a cave, and David had a chance. He cut off a piece of his robe. And another time he was asleep in a valley, and David and his men went down there and took his spear and his water jug and took it back. And the next morning said, by the way, you know, who do these things belong to? Oh, David, I'm so sorry. You know, why would I be out here chasing you? You know, David said, I could have killed you twice now, but I respect the Lord's anointed.
And did Saul have sons who were also looking for David?
Yes.
Because the sons wanted to be the next king?
The son, Saul's oldest son, we talked about him recently, Jonathan, was David's best friend. And he said, I'd be perfectly happy for David to be the next king, and I'll be right beside him. I'll work with him. But Saul didn't see it that way at all.
But they weren't going around the countryside marauding and stealing things to keep themselves fed.
Well, we know that a little bit later, and it may have been somewhere not too far from this time, David actually moved out of the Judean territory into Philistine territory, and the Philistines actually allotted him a small town where he and his people lived. And what he did while he was there is he would go out and he would pretend like he and his men were going to attack Israel. So it looked like to the Philistines like he was attacking his own people. But in fact, he would go over to the Amalekites, or he'd go over to one of the other smaller Philistine towns or one of those places, and he would attack them so viciously he would leave not a trace of anyone that could report on what he had done. And he would come back and see all the booty I got from going out there and attacking those Israelite towns. David was living a lie.
Wow.
Yeah, that seems kind of deceptive. Big time.
Yeah. Well, in this case, in our story for today, in 1 Samuel 25, Nabal's reply to David's men suggested that he considered David and his men to be no better than the marauding bands that were trying to that David was trying to protect him from. He even suggested that David and his men might be runaway slaves. You can see that in verses 10 and 11. Well, when David's men returned empty-handed, David summoned 400 of the 600 men and said, we're going to destroy that evil, worthless, good-for-nothing man. And I suspected that David knew how much wealth there was down there, so there was probably more than one motive involved here.
Yeah.
When the servants of Nabal heard about what had happened, probably someone was standing around when Nabal gave this nasty response to David's men, who knew what David and his men had done to try to protect Nabal's flocks, They went straight to Abigail and told her how David's men had protected them through the winter. Now, do you think this is the first time they'd ever gone to Abigail under those circumstances?
Sounds like they've been there before, doesn't it?
They've been there before. They were used to going to Abigail to sort out problems to keep peace in the neighborhood. Yeah, if there was a problem, Nabal was, you know, stingy and gruff and not very friendly. And Abigail would always sort of smooth the waters and manage to calm things down. Well, they went. These men, workers of Nabal, went straight to Abigail. After listening carefully, immediately took action. Because she knew what was about to happen. She was a wise woman. She knew what was going on. And there's some verses in the Bible. Look at this one, Isaiah 28, verse 23. If you look at the other side of our screen here, listen to what I'm saying. Pay attention to what I'm telling you. This is God suggesting that it's a good idea to learn to be a good listener like Abigail was. Matthew, even Jesus said in the New Testament, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, listen and understand. It's not what goes into a person's mouth and so forth. But Jesus said the same thing. You need to listen. If you want to be on top of things, you need to listen. And James, later in his small book, James 1:19, said, remember this, my dear brothers and sisters. Everyone must be quick to listen, but slow to speak and slow to become angry. So the idea that we need to be good listeners is right through Scripture, beginning to end. Well, what about us? How often do we listen carefully before acting? When hearing of some problem, are we prepared to act? Or are we just sit back and hope it will resolve itself? Or maybe even worse, do we fly off the handle and do something crazy without thinking?
All of the above.
All of the above, right. Unfortunately, it's the custom of people in our day to do emotional responses to something like this happens.
With so much going on with the internet, TV, radio, billboards, everything, don't we get tired of listening?
Well, if you mean by that information overload, then the answer is probably yes. And listening, what makes a good listener?
Someone who's got straight priorities, partly, I think. This is
okay. Tying
in with what you just said. It's very easy to get embroiled in a lot of nonsensical stuff or non-real import. And I think that's where you need to be careful what you watch and listen to. And
yeah.
It's not easy. You're right.
People who do not want to make a mistake, for one thing, may take time to listen. Because maybe they've jumped the gun before and there's been problems.
Yeah. I would like to suggest, think about this, that the basic root problem for people who don't listen is selfishness. Because all they care about is what they're thinking about and what they have to say next. They don't really care what the other person has to say. I think that a person who is truly Christian and truly loving, they care what that other person has to say. They care about what that person thinks, and they try to take that into account before they jump the gun and say what they have to say without thinking.
Is that especially a problem in the context of somebody who has the truth?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we've got the truth. So, I mean, if anyone else wants to argue with it, we don't even have to wait to listen to them because we've got the truth. Right?
Isn't that the way it comes across sometimes, too?
We got to be really careful with that. Yeah, we need to be really careful with that.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I was shy. And so people would talk, and I would listen and listen and just ask a few questions and listen and listen. And I would get the comment, I just love talking to you. And I'm thinking, I never said anything.
They didn't love just listening to you. They loved talking to you.
I was just there.
Yeah. Well, and that's a proof of the fact that if you want someone to really respect you and you want them to care about and think of you as a friend, you need to take time to listen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've all heard stories about couples and how they get together and so forth, and in the early days. You know, it's, boy, whatever that person has to say, you know, the young lady, the man wants to hear every detail and he wants to know more. And the young lady listens to the young man, and whatever he has to say, she wants to know more. That's what you call real relationship building, and that's what happens. They end up getting married, and then they start getting to the place where, well, I don't care what you have to say anymore, you know, and they slip back into their selfish ways.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ecumenism where the goal is to get along with everybody and have one world religion and one world church. Stresses the notion, well, you must listen, you must hear from the other people, you must appreciate the good that they have and learn by it. And it sounds so holy, mm-hmm. but sometimes what they end up then with after that is...
you don't stand for anything.
You don't stand for anything. They have nothing but get along warm fuzzies. And
well, on that, to address that issue, then, if they don't recognize the importance of what this book is about, mm-hmm. you're really going to talk past them. You're just wasting, you're beating your gums. You're just wasting your time and theirs. But if they have a willingness to search for the truth about God and are willing to search for it in here, then you have a basis to start from. Mm-hmm. And then you want to talk with them. You want to try to get an idea where they're coming from. But if they're willing to and want to learn some of the grander things that are offered here, mm-hmm. then you can do it. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time. Like Jesus says, well, dust your feet off if the village won't listen to you. Mm-hmm. Go on.
The line gets blurred, and we live in an age where standards are not what they might be or have been in times past.
Well, they teach in school the national religion in this country is evolution.
Yeah.
Well, that's a completely different ballpark than using this as a basis.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, take that to where what you're talking about, and evolution comes and explains what he believes. We're going to have to listen to him.
Well. It's all right to listen. I think it's all right. You're not going to spend your whole life just listening. Eventually, you're going to have something to say. If you don't listen to him, it's very unlikely he's going to be willing to listen to you. That's the bottom line. If you run, if you both have your minds made up and there's not any chance that you're going to make any progress, then it may be a waste of time.
Well,
you need to at least give him a chance.
Another thing about listening, you listen for things that you have in common so you can make a better conversation. I mean, yeah. You can't just start talking to somebody and expect him to understand or even know where you're coming from.
Yeah.
You've got to kind of...
Does listening truly imply compromise?
It doesn't have to.
No. It shouldn't.
Listening implies that you care about understanding their position. That doesn't necessarily mean you need to compromise with that position.
Sometimes if you listen and you don't say anything, they assume you agree. So you have to be brave enough to...
At some point.
To speak and say what you believe in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Abigail not only listened, but she did something. She sent generous gifts to David. Mm. She didn't waste any moment. Not only that, she followed along behind the gifts on her own little donkey. Yeah. When she approached David, she was thoughtful, courteous, and respectful, as well as beautiful. I'm not sure which was most impressive, whether it was the thoughtful, courteous, respectful, or whether it was the beautiful. But David was very impressed, not only by the gifts, but also by the beauty and courteous manner of Abigail. So while Abigail was calming David's anger, Nabal was at home feasting and reveling with his friends. Like the rich man in the New Testament, and you all know that parable found in Luke 12, 16-21, Nabal was rejoicing in his riches and thinking about building bigger barns, I guess. He drank so much that he collapsed in a stupor. Now, the Bible actually talks about this kind of stuff. Maybe you didn't realize that, but it does. He collapsed in a stupor. When Abigail returned home, she realized his condition, waited until he sobered up. When he had sobered up sufficiently, she told him that David had been intent on killing him. He was so terrified and petrified by this news that his system suffered some kind of shock, and we are told that he died 10 days later.
The RSV says his heart died within him and he became as a stone.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you read between the lines, I tend to think this is not the first time he got plastered.
Yeah.
Which is probably why she took over.
Yeah.
It says here, his heart was very merry, was merry within him, for he was very drunk.
Peterson puts a little on that. He says, right then and there he had a heart attack and fell into a coma.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's one interpretation.
That's an interpretation
for sure. Let me give you another one. This would be a comment from Ellen White, one of the founders of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Although Nabal had refused the needy company of David and his men, yet that very night he made an extravagant feast for himself and his riotous friends. Think about that. And indulged in eating and drinking till he sunk in drunken stupor. The next day, after the effects of his drunken debauch had somewhat passed away, his wife told him of how near he had been to death and of how the calamity had been averted. As he listened, and I wonder what he thought, I hope he had enough respect for his wife that he didn't try to give her a bad time for going against his wishes. Well, as he listened, he realized what a course of evil would have resulted, but for Abigail's discretion. I hope he realized that thoroughly. And terror filled his heart. Palsied with horror, these are Ellen White's words, palsied with horror, he sat down and never recovered from the shock. That's volume 1 of the 21 of the manuscript releases, page 214.
Maybe he did go into a coma.
Yeah.
You know, if he had been eating and drinking like that for several years or the majority of his life, his heart was probably all...
could have been in pretty bad shape already.
Bad shape. And
it's almost a precursor of Belshazzar's feast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Same kind of deal.
Yeah. Well, when David learned that Nabal was dead, guess what he did? He probably waited for the passing of a period of mourning. Usually his period of mourning was about a month, but we don't know for sure. And then sent his soldiers with a proposal of marriage to Abigail. David had been married to Saul's daughter, Michal, who was taken away from him probably after he fled from Saul. And then he was married to Ahinoam of Jezreel. And we can read about that in 1 Samuel 25, 43. But now David proposes to take on a third wife, Abigail. And then there may have been some others. We don't know. These are the first three that we know about. By the way, later he demanded of whoever was involved, I don't know who all was involved, he demanded that he get Michal back again. So even though he had plenty of wives, he wanted that first wife back again.
Why would Abigail marry David when she was left a rich widow and he was an on-the-run fugitive from the king?
That's the question. Now, they were both from the tribe of Judah. That may have had something to do with it. The tribe of Judah was hoping that David was going to be the next king.
Oh, and Abigail had no children, right?
And Abigail had no children.
So maybe she wanted some children.
You have to think of the social ethics of the time. Men still ruled. The women were still considered a lower strata. So she was no fool. You didn't refuse a man like David, who was a military man par excellence and whatever else.
Mm. Yeah. So she said, I'll take my chances. Maybe he'll turn out to be a king.
Mm.
Think something like that. So, what do we learn from this story about Abigail? What should we learn about God from this story? Well, what do we learn from Abigail's speech to David? Look at 1 Samuel 25, starting from verse 23. When Abigail saw David, she quickly dismounted and threw herself on the ground. So this is a very respectful, she's treating him as if he's already a king, okay? At David's feet and said to him, please, sir, listen to me. Let me take the blame. Please don't pay any attention to Nabal, that good for nothing.
Hmm.
Now, it's interesting that we're going to see that she identifies herself with Nabal. She speaks on his behalf, but she clearly clearly recognizes what kind of a character he is, even though she's married to him. He's exactly what his name means, a fool, and that's what the name means in Hebrew. I wasn't there when your servants arrived, sir. It is the Lord who has kept you from taking revenge and killing your enemies. And now I swear to you by the living Lord that your enemies and all who want to harm you will be punished like Nabal. Please, sir, accept this present I have brought you and give it to your men. Please forgive me, sir, for any wrong I have done. What wrong had she done?
Just covering her bases, I think.
Really, she'd been a peacemaker, but
exactly.
she was adhering to the customs of the day and being very careful.
Yeah. The Lord will make you king. See, so she already had some pretty good idea about that. The Lord will make you king. And notice the Lord here is in small caps, meaning it's Yahweh. Yahweh will make you king, and your descendants also, because you are fighting his battles, and you will not do anything evil as long as you live, if only. If anyone should attack you and try to kill you, Yahweh, your God, will keep you safe, as someone guards a precious treasure. As for your enemies, however, he will throw them away, as someone hurls stones with a sling. And when the Lord has done all the good things he has promised you and has made you king of Israel, then you will not have to feel regret or remorse, sir, for having killed without cause or for having taken your own revenge. And when the Lord has blessed you, sir, please do not forget me. David said to her, "Praise the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you today to meet me. Thank God for your good sense and for what you have done today in keeping me from the crime of murder and from taking my own revenge." Of course,
well, that's quite a preamble. When you get a proposal after that interchange, it's not quite as
surprising.
Surprising, exactly. Yeah.
She had wisdom, and she used flattery.
Mm-hmm. Well, she knew what she was talking about.
I think she had some character, though. She obviously wasn't of the wild crowd that were surrounding them there in the outlying areas. She had some moral fiber there somewhere to keep things together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does the Bible say who her parents were?
No, it doesn't. Not as far as I'm aware, no. Well, it's interesting to notice in this exchange that the Bible, in fact, and elsewhere, the Bible talks about people intercede for other people. And what is one of the first things that you have to do if you want to intercede on someone's behalf?
Respect.
Respect. But not in that process of respect, you have to identify yourself with the one you're interceding on behalf of. Okay? Think of some examples. Think of Moses. Remember Exodus 32, 32? Look at that for just a second over here on the right side of our screen. Please, now this is the time when the children of Israel had just finished dancing drunk and naked around that golden calf there at the foot of Mount Sinai. And God tells Moses, you know, let me alone. I'm going to wipe these people out. I'm going to make a new nation out of you. And Moses starts pleading with him. And this he concludes like this. Please forgive their sin, but if you won't, then remove my name from the book in which you have written the names of your people. Now, how is that for identifying yourself? Had Moses done anything wrong? What was he doing while they're drunk and naked around the golden calf?
Talking to God.
He's up there in the very presence of God talking to God.
But Moses is putting himself beneath those people.
He's identifying himself with those people and say, Lord, you know, please, listen carefully. If you can't save them, then take my name out. Maybe you can take my name out, you could save them. I mean, that's an incredible sacrifice he was willing to make.
In view of his past history where he killed the Egyptian and ran, he'd had a character change, a very definite one.
Yeah. And think about Esther. Yeah. She became king, and then her uncle said, or I guess cousin actually said to her, you know, maybe you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And what was the response?
She saved Israel.
She managed to save the Israelites, didn't she? And think about God, the God himself. Look at Romans 8:26. Now, we understand there are three members of the Godhead. There's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. If you read the last part of Romans 8, you realize that every single member of the Godhead is pleading for us. We don't have a son pleading for the Father to forgive us. Notice these words. Romans 8:26, in the same way the Spirit also comes to help us, weak as we are, for we don't know how we ought to pray. But the Spirit himself pleads with God for us in groans that words cannot express. And God, who sees into our hearts, knows what the thought of the Spirit is, because the Spirit pleads with God on behalf of his people and in accordance with his will. So it's pretty clear that the Spirit is on our side, right?
It says pleads with God, or the RSV says intercedes for the saints. It doesn't say that he's trying to win God over.
Yeah.
God's trying to win us to be in harmony with him.
We're going to talk about that in just a moment, so keep your thought there. We know that in all things, God works for good with those who love him, those whom he has called according to his purposes. Those whom God had already chosen, he goes on and talks about how, you know, he's working, he wants to save everybody. And it says, in view of all this, what can we say? If God is for us, referring to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, who can be against us? Certainly not God, who did not even keep back his own Son. I mean, what kind of evidence is that? I mean, you think God the Father is against us if he gave his Son to come and live among us and die for us? I mean, surely not.
Now, you're saying to be a good interceder for someone, you need to identify with the people that you're interceding for.
Yep.
And you're saying that God so identifies with us that he sent his Son. Mm-hmm. And so God is identifying with us to be a good interceder.
Mm-hmm. John 3:16. Mm-hmm. For God so loved the world.
Yeah.
Well, look how Christ identified with us. He was God. He came down in person and lived with us.
Suffered the abuse of his creatures.
Yeah.
Beat him up and...
Talk about identification.
You know, for somebody to do that, though, they've got to believe that there's some value in the person that they're interceding for.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
if it's possible that they may not, that a person may not have that value, then would they still intercede that way?
Well,
I mean, I'm thinking about some of the prophets. You know, some of the mm-hmm. prophets stick with Israel no matter what happened. You know, that seems like he's fallen, that what you're talking about. But then there's others that wanted to leave, but they wouldn't let him leave.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of wonder.
But Abigail wasn't totally there. She had another bit of logic too. When God completes all the goodness he has promised my master and sets you up as prince over Israel, my master will not have this dead weight in his heart, the mm-hmm. guilt of an avenging murder.
Yes.
Easy, buddy. Don't do something you don't want to live with.
Yeah. Right. Very appropriate. Yeah.
She was rather wise, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we go over to 1 John, many people, when they want to talk about pleading with God and intercession, they think immediately of 1 John chapter 2, verse 1. I'm writing this to you, my children, so that you will not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have someone who pleads with the Father on our behalf, Jesus Christ, the righteous one.
Let me go back to what Abigail mm-hmm. was doing okay. with David. In the next chapter mm-hmm. is the story of where Saul comes out and David is there and has the chance to
actually kill him.
And David says, I can't do that to him.
God's anointed.
I wonder if the interaction that he had just had yeah. with Abigail
mm-hmm. might
not have had some influence on his action at this point.
I bet
possible.
So.
All those who really want to make a big deal out of the intercession need to read John 16:25-27. And this is very interesting. It's a challenging verse for us to understand. These are some of the very last words that Jesus spoke to his disciples before he was crucified. I mean, when he had them as a group. And these are his words, Jesus' own words. And, you know, he knew what was coming, so he wasn't wasting his time here. He wasn't just chatting away. I have used figures of speech to tell you these things, but the time will come when I will not use figures of speech, but will speak to you plainly about the Father. When that day comes, you will ask him in my name, and I do not say, notice, I do not say that I will ask him on your behalf. For the Father himself loves you. He loves you because you love me, and so forth and so forth. So here we have the Gospel of John say, I'm not going to plead with the Father. And 1 John says, pray to Jesus because he's going to plead with the Father for us. Now, is John confused here or what?
I am a little.
Well, if you notice, it says he's speaking plainly, and this is right at the end of his mission. Yeah. Because back in Matthew 13:33, it says Jesus did no teaching except through the means of parables or figures of speech. Mm-hmm. And now at the end, talking plainly, and then the disciple says, now you're talking plainly and not in any figures.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently, God can only lead people at the pace that they're able to digest it and understand it.
To follow your point there, dropping down to verse 29 in that same chapter, John 16, then the disciples said to him, now you're speaking plainly without using figures of speech. So they understood that this was plain language about God. We know now that you know everything. You do not need someone to ask you questions. This makes us believe that you came from God.
Now, John, the same John wrote the 1 John, and RSV says, we have an advocate with the Father. Now, I've got to remember some of these. I don't know what how the Greek could translate it, how much latitude you have there.
Yeah, the Greek says we have an advocate, proston theon, in this case, proston petron, which would mean before the Father, in front of the Father, but it could mean with the Father. All of those are possibilities.
Well, the Holy Spirit, Jesus, the Father are always trying to communicate. They're trying to teach us. Mm-hmm. We didn't start out with all knowledge, and here we try to think about the infinite using finite terms, and we have to do this.
Well, now, why? Now, how do you explain the word pleading on what is that, Corinthians?
Well, the one I was just at.
Yeah,
that was John 16, or you talking which one?
Well, whom he is pleading. Jesus is pleading in our behalf with whom he is pleading.
Oh, this is John. Well, I'm not sure which verse you're thinking about.
On the other side there. The first one you were talking about the pleading. Uh-huh. And then you got another verse where he says he doesn't have to plead.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, why is that? It seems like it's not clearer. It seems like he's changing his tune. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's not clear, that means it's fuzzy. But pleading isn't fuzzy. It's just something different than not pleading. So,
well, look at another example of pleading in the Bible found in Daniel 9. This might give us some clues. O Lord our God. Now, this is a prayer of Daniel. Daniel realizes that now they're coming close to the end of the 70-year prophecy. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah had told them that they were going to be in captivity for 70 years, and Daniel says, okay, Lord, the time is getting close. Please do something. What I see is that your people are settling down in here in Babylon. They're getting accustomed to Babylonian ways. They're speaking the Babylonian language. I'm afraid that we're just going to melt into Babylonian society. There's not going to be anything left of us. And this is his prayer to God. Oh, Lord, our God, you showed your power by bringing your people out of Egypt, and your power is still remembered. We have sinned. We have done wrong. Notice, we have sinned. We have done wrong. You have defended us in the past, so do not be angry with Jerusalem any longer. It is your city, your sacred hill. All the people in the neighboring countries look down on Jerusalem and on your people because of our sins and the evil of our ancestors did. Oh God, hear my prayer and pleading. Restore your temple, which has been destroyed. Restore it so that everyone will know that you are God. Listen to us, O God. Look at us and see the trouble we are in and the suffering of the city that bears your name. We are praying to you because you are merciful, not because we have done right. And then this punchline for an end. Lord, hear us, Lord. Forgive us. Lord, listen to us and act in order that everyone will know that you are God. Do not delay. This city and these people are yours. Daniel understood very well that the nations around considered Yahweh to be a worthless God because his people are in captivity. And since we're talking about David, I keep wanting to go to David. Daniel's saying, God, you need to stand up for your own name's sake. How often do we pray encouraging God and encouraging ourselves to do something for God's sake, but not only that, to encouraging God to do something for his name's sake? That sounds more like John 16, doesn't it?
Okay, so when you talk about pleading, are you trying to change God's mind?
Well, here's one of the few places. There are a couple of places in the Bible where it seems to talk about this pleading very specifically. Let's look at those. Zechariah 3, 1-5. In another vision, the Lord showed me the high priest Joshua standing before the angel of the Lord. Now, in this case, Joshua is the high priest, is basically representing all the Jewish people, all the Israelite people at this time. And there beside Joshua stood who?
Satan.
Ready to bring an accusation against him. Who is accusing God's people?
Satan.
If we go over to Revelation 12, I'm not going to take time to go over there right now. Revelation 12, about verse 10, it calls Satan the accuser of our brethren. And that would be sisters too. So who is accusing in these situations? Satan is the one accusing. If Satan's accusing us, do we need someone to defend us?
But
yes.
why would you use the logic of identifying with the sinner if what you're arguing about is with Satan?
Well, no. So, well, put it this way. If Jesus didn't care about us, he didn't want to identify with us at all, he wouldn't bother arguing with Satan. He'd just say, take the bunch of sinners. See if I care. But Jesus identifies himself with us. He says, I can't let these people go. They're my children. So he's identifying with us. Jesus is identifying with us. And now, in order to try to resolve issues in the universe, he's making the cases clear before the rest of the universe. And that's Daniel 7, verses 9 and 10. Let's look at that. We go to Daniel 7, we find, while I was looking, thrones were put in place. One who had been living forever sat down on one of the thrones. His clothes were white as snow, and his hair was like pure wool. His throne, mounted on fiery wheels, was blazing with fire, and a stream of fire was pouring out from it. There were many thousands of people there to serve him, and millions of people stood before him. The court began its session, and the books were open. And then it goes on to explain about the judgment. So, it's not Jesus defending us before the Father. It's Jesus responding to the accusations that Satan has made against us before our future neighbors and friends, the angels and the other millions of people who are living in the universe. So I think that's very appropriate.
Now,
I still don't understand the word pleading, though. When you plead, is it like a court case? Do you plead guilty or not guilty?
Well,
or
it's
is it
in the case?
Yeah, or is it a
legally? That's a statement of a case. Here's my case. Here's my client. Here's my case.
That's what a lawyer does in front of a judge. He
called
pleads.
It's called a plea.
So, isn't he trying to get the judge to go one way or the other?
Well, he's trying to convince the judge of the rightness of his case.
But we got to go back to Job 1 and 2 mm-hmm. also. This is all going forth.
Sure.
The whole universe is looking on. The heavenly councils are so. Yeah. All God is doing, the adversary is there making up lies. He's also putting some truth in there, which is deception. That's what makes it deception.
And he's going to twist everything as much as he can to make it look good for his side.
And his whole argument really is against God and against Jesus. That's who
and
he's
against
really
us.
Good. Yeah. But he's using our case to discredit God.
Yeah. Well, what if you said the word pleading was another word for passionate? Say that I am pleading to the Lord. I am passionate about what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily asking him to change his mind, but to show or give some sort of indication, I really mean this, mm-hmm. you know, type of thing. So yeah. could that be a meaning of pleading in this case?
Well, let's look at some possible options there.
Could advocate, I've heard the word advocate, it's someone that wants to defend you, support yeah. you,
advocate
speak for
is
you.
Is the British name for a lawyer.
Yeah. But plea is a multi-shaded meaning word.
Mm-hmm. I don't like the word plea, yeah.
At the end of a pleading, you have a prayer.
Yeah.
That's what you're asking for, but
advocate
you don't like the word prayer. Well, it's old English is what we're dealing with, so we're trying to bring it up today.
Prayer is pleading?
Well, it's at the end of the pleading.
Stating
we're talking
case.
About legal documents, you see.
It's got multi-meanings.
So.
Okay, let's try to pull this together. Does the Father need someone to plead with him before he will forgive and accept us?
No.
Why not? How do you know that?
Because he has been forgiveness since the...
Well, and we just read John 16:26. Jesus said, I don't need to plead to the Father.
Well, Jesus said, forgive these people crucifying. They don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be nice, though, as far as God's concerned, if somebody agreed with him.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
So if somebody's pleading the Father, that he's really agreeing with him. Mm-hmm. You can look at it that way, too.
Wasn't there somebody
with passion?
Yeah. Wasn't there some years ago a minister says, if we don't have somebody pleading with the Father, all is lost.
Yeah,
and it's their paradigm is such to embrace John 16:25 and 26 is, man, that's one big leap
for
them.
Why are so many Christians concerned about this pleading? There are people, there are Christians who believe that if Christ is not pleading with the Father, all is lost, as you suggested.
Well, that's the problem. God has gotten a bad rap back from the time Lucifer started doing his thing. Mm-hmm. War arose in heaven, Revelation 12:7, yeah. And it's all based upon deception. We're not talking about black and white. We're talking about shades of gray that are slanted or the deck stacked against a truth.
Mm-hmm. God is well aware of our status. It's never off his mind at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, like if you were a person, like me, and I sent my son to help these people on this remote island, would those people then have to beg and plead with me to listen to them? No, because I had initiated... Mm-hmm. When they didn't even know they were in trouble on the island.
But you used that word. You used that word plead, and it's valid, with your illustration there. But what we're saying is that word is not really meant that way as written in the Bible.
We're stuck with the God-human thing that we can't understand. We see the words sound like somebody trying to convince somebody of to change their mind. That's what the wording sounds like. And then we sit back and we say, but that's God talking to God. They're one and the same. They have the same attitudes. Why do we need this language? And I'm not sure that we can actually sort our way all the way through it.
No, we
can't. Well, I want to throw a couple more pieces into this pie, and then we need to move on because some other things we need to talk about. If you go back in the Bible and you follow carefully through, you discover something quite interesting. The very first time there's anyone doing anything like pleading, or like asking for intercession, it's actually in Exodus 20. Immediately after the giving of the Ten Commandments, God comes down in this black cloud, the lightning and the thunder and all this kind of stuff, and the people are there with their faces down in the dirt, and they're saying, oh, please, they're sure they're going to die. And finally, when all that sort of lets up for a moment, they said to Moses, you go and talk to God, and then you come back and talk to us, but don't let God talk to us again or we'll die. So who is asking for the pleading? They're asking for the intercessor. They're asking for this. It wasn't God who asked for an intercessor.
So you're saying that the model that was given of the sanctuary and the pleading and the process of the intermediary, the priest taking over, dealing with the sin, was given because they asked for something in this mode of pleading?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, a couple of other things I want to look at. We don't know much of what happened to Abigail after this. There's evidence that she had a son. It's interesting that one part of the Bible, it says the son's name was Chileab, and another area it says his name was Daniel, depending on whether you want to believe 1 Chronicles 3:1 or 2 Samuel 3:3.
Was this a son by David?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we don't know whether in the violent times that came up later, one of David's other sons sort of got rid of them to avoid any threats to their throne. Because, this was like the second or third son in line to be the next king. We don't know what happened. We just don't know. But there's another interesting bit that I think we should talk about. Look at 1 Samuel 25:38. We've already talked about the fact that Nabal died, and it says here in verse 38, some 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. Now, you were trying to pawn this off to some kind of heart attack or something. The Lord struck him. Now, this is clear why he died.
Well, he has to use a mechanism of some kind. It's a physiologic thing.
I see. Well, why does the Bible say the Lord struck him? I mean, that should be, that's not right, right?
Verse 37 says his heart died. Huh? Verse 37 says his heart died. So maybe it's a limited amount of language that they had to describe the event, but apparently he wasn't completely dead. So he went, wait till 10 days later. I don't know.
But if Nabal was this rotten egg that nobody liked, and he ended up crunked, somebody's going to say, God did it. Good job.
Life comes from God. Why can't he take it back when he says it's time? Yeah. We don't really know. Or is it an old English meaning there that we don't really go with?
God gets credit for everything, good or bad, in the minds of these people.
Yeah.
And so they write it that way.
Let's look at one other story that's close to the same time period, very close to the same time period, 1 Samuel 31. Look at 1 Samuel 31, verses 1 to 4. This might give us a clue. The Philistines fought a battle against the Israelites on Mount Gilboa. Many Israelites were killed there, and the rest of them, including King Saul and his sons, fled. But the Philistines caught up with him and killed three of Saul's sons, Jonathan, that was his firstborn, Abinadab and Malchishua. The fighting was heavy around Saul, and he himself was hit by enemy arrows and badly wounded. He said to the young man carrying his weapons, "Draw your sword and kill me so that these godless Philistines won't gloat over me and kill me." But the young man who was too terrified to do it. So Saul took his own sword and threw himself on it. Now, how would we describe that in modern English?
Suicide. Yeah.
Ultimately, we understand that he was probably going to die as a result, but we would call that a suicide.
Is that where the term "he fell on his sword" came from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if you turn over to 1 Chronicles, where the same story is told in 1 Chronicles chapter 10, there's some interesting additions to the story. The fighting was heavy around Saul. He was hit by enemy arrows. Badly wounded, he said to the young man carrying his weapons, "Draw your sword." Exactly the same words. So Saul took his own sword and threw himself on it. Now, the young man saw what happened. He threw himself on his sword. But if you go down to verses 13 and 14, excuse me, Saul died because he was unfaithful to the Lord. He disobeyed the Lord's commands. He tried to find guidance by consulting the spirits of the dead instead of consulting the Lord. So, the Lord killed him, gave control of the kingdom to David, son of Jesse. So here, in just a few short years, maybe only 2, 3, 4 years apart, God's killed two main Bible characters.
So God is responsible for Saul falling on his sword.
I just read it to you.
Look, let me ask you a question. Could he have fallen on his sword if God didn't want it to happen?
Well, no. Do you think God that God takes himself away from people when they don't want him and then destructive things happen?
But he pulls the plug then. He takes himself away in order that something else can happen.
Well, Saul turned God away by going against what he knew God wanted him to do.
All of God's instructions.
I was going to say, Saul, in effect, was responsible for his own death. God had warned him, and if you look in the story there, they cleaned out all the mediums that they could find in the nation not that long before.
Yes.
And if you read it, when he got to the witch of Endor, she said she recognized who he was. "You going to kill me?" Mm-hmm. So he finally did and turned his back on what he knew to be right.
Yeah.
You know, the buck always stops at the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
I mean, even if Satan did something on his own accord, God is the one that gave him free choice to do it. And so it always ends up back to him. And
that's right. And
I don't see any problem with that if you understand what that means.
To the ancient Hebrew mind, there was only one God.
Mm-hmm.
You can read that, Deuteronomy 6:4, Mark 12:29. They were monotheists, the technical theological term for that. While the nations around them had many gods, some of them were considered to be good gods and others to be evil gods. When something unexpected happened, especially if it was also unexplainable and to humans, they attributed it to one or more of their gods. If it was something good, it was attributed to a good god. If it was something bad, it was attributed to an evil god. But Israel claimed to serve only one god. Now what do you do? So everything that happened was considered
him for everything.
Yeah, considered to be his activity, especially if it seemed beyond human ability to accomplish.
Right.
Thus, everything that was not obviously caused by some known action was attributed to the one God. Today, we might say that whatever God does not cause, he at least permits.
Yeah.
Basically, same idea. Mm-hmm. If God did not exercise this constant restraint on the devil would immediately destroy anyone who had even pretended to be a follower of God. So when Saul committed suicide, it was considered to be an act of God because Saul had fought many previous battles, and we know this to be the case, and he hadn't been killed. Why was this? If he had not turned away from God and had not disobeyed God's directions repeatedly, no doubt God would have continued to protect him and his sons. Thus it was thought that in a larger sense, God killed Saul. Well, what about Nabal now? Coming back to Nabal. We know nothing about why Nabal died. Some of our translators speculated what might have happened. Maybe long-term effects of alcohol consumption, maybe a heart attack, maybe a stroke. Any one of those things are possible. But, in effect, what are we saying? We're saying that God didn't prevent it, at least, right?
That's right.
So,
do the Israelite people believe in an active devil and demons?
Some of them did. A lot of them didn't seem to recognize that he exists. Well, do we ever attribute things to God which are not his doing?
Yeah, they talk about acts of God when we have an earthquake.
In insurance policies.
Insurance policy, yeah.
And it's always the bad things they talk about God. They don't give God credit for anything else. It's bad.
Well, because they don't have to pay for good things that happen.
Right.
Almost everybody that dies, they say God took him.
Yeah. God took him away.
Well, so then, looking at this story and looking at this part and all the things we've discussed, does it really matter whether, why do we focus on what it says about God? Does it matter what we think about God? Well, there's a couple of quotations here, and again, I turn to my friend Ellen White. We are not to think of God only as a judge. Remember our talk about an intercessor. Mm-hmm. And to forget him as our loving father. Nothing can do our souls greater harm than this, for our whole spiritual life will be molded by our conceptions of God's character. Advent Review and Sabbath Herald, April 5, 1887. And then, multitudes have a wrong conception of God. Notice, multitudes have a wrong conception of God and his attributes and are as truly serving a false God as were the worshipers of Baal. Prophets and Kings, 177. Friends, we need to read our Bibles and get a clear, correct picture of God if we want to be in the kingdom. See you there.